So Tim, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Okay. Well, let me just first say that I'm really excited to talk to you, and I love what you're doing. I listen to your podcast. I don't watch the videos, but you know, as we were just talking about before you started recording, I have this. I don't know what it is, and I'd like to know if you have a name for it. Is this something that sometimes I feel compelled to do things sometimes, and like, I don't even know exactly why I emailed you the story that I emailed you, but it just felt like it was the right thing to do, and I did it. And I feel like that's kind of what you're doing with the videos. And, you know, I'm not trying to be presumptuous, but I feel like that's what it is, and I have a lot of respect for that. And you seem like a really authentic guy, and I appreciate that. And your videos are, well, your podcasts for me are very helpful, especially the ones where you're talking to other recovering atheists, so to speak. And I really liked, I have notes over here if you see me looking to the side, because I'm a lawyer and I write everything down. I really liked the one about Western philosophy and religion, and your, the recommendation to read City of God. I'm just kind of starting that, but I love that. I had no idea.
It's a crazy book, huh?
It's unbelievable. And the Audible on that is very helpful.
Yeah.
And then your recent discussion about Alex Jones. Sometimes I listen to Verbeke. I listen to Jonathan Peugeot. I've heard, you know, almost everything Jordan Peterson's done. But sometimes even when I feel like I understand those things, I'll then listen to you talk about it, and something new will come out of it, or you'll say it in a way that I didn't, that helps me understand it even better. And so, just so you know, that it's great.
Oh, thank you.
So I, about me, I'm a husband to a wonderful woman. I have two daughters who are 12 and 10. I'm 43 years old, and I am a bankruptcy lawyer. I wanted to talk to you, I guess, primarily about an experience that happened to me. I started the email that I sent you before this particular experience that's been the most remarkable one for me. I just wanted to talk about what Jordan Peterson did and how that experience went, because I know you're trying to put your finger on what it is that Jordan Peterson is helping people with. And so that was kind of the reason I just felt like, well, you know, I have a story, so let me just send this to Paul and see if this, you know, does anything. I guess maybe I'll just get started with it. I've always been atheist as long as I can remember. I think my parents took me to church maybe one time. I don't remember the one time. I have a grandmother who's still alive at 100 years old, and she apparently took me to Sunday school a few times. She went to Baptist church. And this just goes to how I feel about my atheism being like forever. I have a memory for some reason of being in her Sunday school when I must've been like 4 or 5 years old. And I have a feeling attached to the memory, and it's a feeling of like just uncomfortableness and even disgust. And I mean, maybe lots of people feel that way in Bible school, but for some reason that ties into just like my whole identity of being atheist. And when I was, I went to school in a very small town of like 2,500 people. And it was a Czechoslovakian immigrant town. And so as far as I knew, everybody there went to church, and almost all of them were Catholic. And in middle school, I was the kid who never went to church, who was definitely going to hell.
Wow.
I mean, they weren't cruel like that, but that was me. So I've always been atheist, and I married a woman who's atheist. And I've always had anxiety up until very recently. And for some reason, I've thought for a while now that the two are actually related. But the anxiety, like I played lots of sports in school, but for example, I would have to go vomit before a basketball game. It was a type of insecurity to where I could excel in basketball practice because I love basketball, but you get in the game and you know how people are right there up on you.
Sure.
Thinking about that, I could never perform under that type of situation as well as I wanted to. Mm-hmm. And it would cause me to avoid things lots of times, mm-hmm. Procrastinate. Mm-hmm. And if you ask people who knew me from back then, I think they would say that I was the guy who was laid back and easygoing. and didn't, that wasn't serious. I think what I was doing was compensating for that. I think it was really just a way to try to make up and deal with the anxiety that I felt about everything. And so this guy who didn't care that much about stuff and never studied in school, couldn't focus and concentrate very well. When I was 16 years old, I discovered through some other means, my parents, my family's not musical, but I heard about this violinist composer named Paganini that I didn't know anything about. But I went and I got a cassette of Paganini from a music store back when, you know, you had to go to music stores. And I listened to it. And the first time I listened to it, it was like being struck by lightning.
Wow.
Immediately I told my parents, you have to get me a violin and I have to start taking lessons. And I had been playing the guitar, so it wasn't totally crazy, mm-hmm. but it was pretty crazy. Mm-hmm. But they did that. And I progressed very quickly at first. After 4 months, I was playing in the Waco Youth Symphony. And I completely fell in love with it. So I cared about something, and I cared really deeply about it. And I probably cared about other things too, but you know, it's because I was pretending not to. This was something that I actually didn't pretend not to care about. And after about a year of lessons, my teacher told my parents that something like I had more talent than anybody should ever taught, and that I could major in it in college. So that was all I wanted to do. And then, so I went and did that, but because I didn't know how to work hard at anything, because I never took anything seriously before, and because I was, you know, people who major in violin in college, they start when they're like five, around yeah. there. So I was about a decade behind.
Yeah.
And after 2 years, I just didn't make it. I had to audition in order to continue on, and I didn't pass the audition. And about the same time, the only serious girlfriend I ever had broke up with me. And my parents, who I actually thought that they had a good, like, exemplary marriage, they didn't, but I thought they did.
They
were getting separated and ultimately got divorced.
Wow.
And so it was like, I, you know, going from not caring or pretending to not care to like putting all of my eggs in these baskets. And really I was a romantic type feeling person about music and about this girl and everything. And then it all just poof went away like that. And I was really depressed. And my reaction was to just get really practical. And I guess pragmatic. And I decided, okay, I'm going to change majors. I'm going to go to law school. Because I had actually already borrowed some money to go to school. And so I was already dealing with student loan debt. And I was going to give up the violin. But I actually didn't. I harbored the secret wish that I could figure out how to still make up the distance between me and what a professional or even just a teacher of the violin could do. Yeah. And so I carried that with me, but I moved and I got to tell you the story about how I met my wife though. So I moved to College Station, and very out of character for me, I picked a store at the mall because I felt like I needed to get a job because of financial issues, and walked into, it was JCPenney, and said, I need a job. I need to see the manager. I didn't know if they were hiring. I didn't fill an application. Nothing like that. Totally out of character for me. And I think the guy was so impressed, he just gave me a job right then. And the first day on the job, I met my wife.
Wow.
She worked at JCPenney also.
Wow.
And you know what I think about that? I think, look what I did. I slayed the dragon and got the girl.
That's
you
know, right.
And I can't help but think about it that way.
That's right.
And so anyway, because of the everything that had happened to me, I actually was not really prepared for that. For her, it was like love at first sight. For me, I was uneasy about the whole thing. But we worked it out, and we moved in together. And another quick story I'll tell you about this is that she went to school in a town about an hour away. And so we lived in a small, really small town in between the two, out in the country. And we lived in a trailer, like a mobile home. And the great thing about it was that there was nothing but farmland as far as you could see all around us. And their trailer had a porch. And so you could go out on the porch and just stare off into infinity, basically. And it was gorgeous and so quiet. Anyway, I asked her to marry me in that trailer. And then we got married at the Justice of the Peace in Huntsville, Texas. And after we got married, we went back to the trailer and I had some champagne and cake and flowers and that. And so we celebrated a little bit and it rained. And then we go outside on the porch and there's a full double rainbow right there, right outside the porch. Right from end to end, you could see the whole thing. Wow. I'd never seen anything like that. I'd never seen one like that since, except for online. And my atheist wife says to me something like, that means we were meant to be, you know? It even affected her like that. And I said something like, yeah, well, I don't believe in that stuff. So anyway, I'm married. I get a job because I wanted to get it. I found a job that I thought was good to determine whether I wanted to go to law school or not, because I was actually managing litigation, which meant I was sort of managing lawyers. And so we buy a house, all this stuff is going great, but I'm getting up early in the morning to practice violin. I'm leaving work early to go home and practice the violin. I'm practicing like 2 to 4 hours on the weekend.
Wow.
And my wife hates it, right? Everything else is great, but she can't stand that. And I don't blame her. And I didn't really know why I was doing it. I learned that I did not want to go to law school. But because of financial pressures, again, because of student loans. And back at this time, they didn't have the different things that you can do with student loans that you can do them now. You couldn't even extend the repayment plan back then. It was 10 years, whether you could afford it or not. And so I thought, well, of course, I'm going to take on more loans and go to law school. But then at least I'll be able to pay them back. And so I did that. And I managed to actually not play the violin for 3 years while I was in law school. But my anxiety just got really bad. I developed GERD, which is gastroesophageal reflux disease or disorder. I'm not sure which D word it is, but I wasn't overweight or anything. It was just stress. I already had seborrheic dermatitis. I got eczema. When I was studying for the bar, I got prostatitis, which I would not recommend.
Doesn't sound good.
No, it was bad. So it was all of the responsibility. I mean, here again, it was like the guy who still doesn't care that much about stuff, you know, not serious about things. And then when you're the lawyer, you got to be the adult in the room all the time. Yeah. And you can't make mistakes and you got to look out for danger down the road. And so you have to be vigilant all the time. And that was so anathema to me as my identity. For anything except the violin, I took that seriously, but this other stuff was totally different, and it was really hard for me to deal with. And my dog died while I was studying for the bar, but I passed the bar, and I got a job, and then shortly thereafter, my wife got pregnant. So now I'm about to be a dad, I'm a lawyer, my dog, who I associated still with childhood a little bit, died, and all of this pressure and everything, I thought, I can't die not having accomplish what I want to accomplish with the violin. And I still can't tell you exactly why I had thoughts like that, but there were things that I wanted to do, and it was like that was where I got meaning from, I guess, or the place that it was most, that was the thing that was most salient to me. Mm-hmm. And so I went back to practicing, and I would wait till everybody went to bed at night, practice till like midnight, and then go be a lawyer. And those were long hours. And I just kept doing that regardless of how difficult it was and how much my wife still hated it. And we would fight about it sometimes. And this went on for a long time. And I was kind of stuck because I couldn't figure out, I never got good enough to actually do the violin thing. I did make progress. The other thing about it was I wanted to apply the focus that I learned in law school because I had to finally learn how to study. Mm-hmm. And it really helped. It really worked. I got much, much better. And I was having a great time when I was playing. It was wonderful. But when I wasn't playing, I was anxious all the time. But the violin, that was that thing that made me lose time, mm-hmm. you know, that Jordan Peterson talked about. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I couldn't figure out what to do. I played around with even quitting being a lawyer for a while. And I was listening to podcasts to try to help. And I was very, only thing I could do was I became more and more detached. So I became more and more numb to like everything. And then for whatever reason, I heard his first podcast with Joe Rogan. I listened to Joe Rogan, but I had no idea who he was or anything. Yeah. And I'm listening to his podcast and it's just like I got hit in the head with a hammer. I burst into tears. And it was, he talked about on that podcast, he said something like that thing that you, when you do it, you lose time. I don't know why everybody doesn't just do that. He said something like that. And when I heard that, I was like, yeah, why did I give up on that thing? You know, why, what made me, because I felt like the world was telling me, okay, you tried and it didn't work. You have to be practical now. And so I felt like I kind of betrayed myself in a way. And then I heard him saying, well, you shouldn't have done that. That's what I heard. And suddenly I realized all these mistakes I made. But at the same time, I heard him saying, yeah, well, that thing that captures your interest, it will take you down into the underworld. I heard that clearly. And I felt, I felt like I just didn't work hard enough. You know, the whole, I was Cain. It was my fault. And there was something, but there was, at the same time that, he just totally devastated me. And it was like all these things lined up in my mind like never before. And I didn't totally understand it. It was like it was in the periphery, you know. Some, I could kind of get a glimpse of this understanding now. And what I knew though was that I had to know how in the hell this guy knew this stuff. Where was this coming from? And I felt like listening to him was one thing, but I had to really know it. And so I needed to read his book, and I needed to read the books that he read. And I didn't know how that was going to help, but I just started doing that. And I read Maps of Meaning. It took me like 9 months to read it. And part of the reason was because I read Crime and Punishment at the same time. But another reason was that I would read a page of that book and then I'd have to go think about it for like 3 days. Because, you know, it makes sense in one way. And then I think about it and it keeps making sense on all these other levels. And it's just blowing my mind. And there were so many times when just reading the book, it would bring me to tears. And the same thing happened with The Brothers Karamazov. When I read that, same thing happened. Especially The Grand Inquisitor. It was like all these things that were tightly wound up with the way that I thought about the world getting destroyed. And I swear I could feel it happening. And I had these emotional, physical responses when it would happen. And then I read another book. I mean, I read first two volumes of the Gulag Archipelago. I read Man's Search for Meaning. I read some Jung. I read a bunch of stuff, but one book in particular called More Than Allegory by Bernardo Kastrup. And Bernardo Kastrup is got a PhD in computer engineering, and he's a former materialist atheist. And his story, basically, that I know of it, is that he had a religious experience and then gave up materialism. And he has been spending his life, as far as I can tell, for many years now, writing books to help to flesh out all of his thoughts on why materialism is wrong, why the world is fundamentally consciousness, and to help other people get to, you know, get there. And More Than Allegory is one of these books where it really tries to help other people get to where he is, to get to idealism. And it's a fantastic book. The first part of it really is a lot like Maps of Meaning because it goes through myth and religion and stuff like that. But the last part of the book, he sets up his own myth, which is centered on psychedelics. He creates this story where he becomes a part of a scientific experiment with psychedelics to prolong the psychedelic experience. And then somehow it's just fantasy, of course, but a serum to help you remember the things that you learn when you're in the experience. There's this thing about, you know, you have these profound experiences, but then you have trouble remembering exactly what happened. So you can bring that back. And when I finished that book, and again, when I was reading it, I could tell that my mind was changing. But when I finished that book, I completely and totally believed in God, number one.
Wow.
That's what that book did to me, because it did for me. Because it gave I just needed some kind of scientific tie-in to consciousness being fundamental. Mm-hmm. And he gave that to me. Mm-hmm. And then when I believed that, then all of the ramifications of that start working in my mind. And I all of a sudden I can understand what fear of God means, right? I never got that before. And I understand what God having a plan means. And I start to think, well, yeah, I mean, I believe that. And I want to participate in the plan in the right way. I don't want to be on the opposite side of infinite consciousness, right?
Right. That's an important thing when you recognize that. It's like, oh.
Yeah, yeah. When you start to really believe in God, it can be a scary thing.
Yes, it is.
And so I thought, well, plus I was having all these experiences, and I was all on this path. So this whole time I'm following this, whatever this is. And if you have a name for it, I'd like for you to tell me what it is, where you just kind of like something tells you that you need to do this, whatever it is, and you do it. And you're trying to stay true to that path. I guess it's the way, maybe, but you're trying to stay true to the path. Okay. And something told me, what?
It's the call.
The call, okay. Something told me you need to go to church. Because maybe I'd have an experience like I had reading Dostoevsky in church, or maybe I'd figure out why it is that I feel like I need to go there. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And because of Peugeot and Dostoevsky and just the whole idea of, I had a feeling that a lot about the services of Orthodox churches were trying to invoke a state of consciousness that would help you connect with the consciousness with God. And so, and then what do you know? There's a Orthodox priest 20 miles from where I live who has a Jordan Peterson meetup. There's that fate again, right? It was like fate. So, of course, I have to go to it. Yeah. And I went there, and it was a great experience. And he's around my age, which... Yeah. You know, you don't always get when you go to church.
Yeah.
So it was easy for me to kind of relate to him. And he showed me around the church a little bit. I think he was surprised that I even asked. But he showed me around, and I really wanted to go. And so I've been trying to prepare my atheist wife for me wanting to go to church. And it was hard. And she was like, why? You know, or why can't we just go to the Unitarian church? Like, you know.
Yeah. At least if you go to that church, you don't have to believe anything.
Right. Yeah. See, by the way, you're laughing. I tell you know what I mean. So I was like, no, I have to go to this one. And so I went to the one that I thought was going to be the least difficult, which was Vespers on Saturday. And, you know, there's not that many people there. And it was a really nice service. And my wife said that she liked it. And my kids hated it. But we did that, and then the next weekend I wanted to go again, and we went again. Everybody was, except for my kids were not very tolerant, but my wife was. And then, so, you know, I was like, well, I really need to go. The main thing is the Divine Liturgy on Sundays. I think I got to go to that. She said, okay, well, I don't want to go. And the kids didn't want to go. So I went, and, you know, at the Orthodox Church, it's like half the day. Because I went for the matins, which is the early one. And then the Divine Liturgy is like 2 hours. So that's three. And then I stayed for the Bible study. They have Bible study for converts afterwards. And I stayed for that because I wanted to. And then after 4 hours of being gone, I come home. And I thought it was a wonderful experience. It was great. Everybody was really welcoming. I kissed the cross after the service, which is, you know, again, all of this is totally beyond who I am, right? Yeah. Not in my... keeping with my character at all. Yeah. And I get home and I feel great about it. And my wife is mad. She's like, she's not happy.
Gone for 4 hours on a weekend day.
Yeah. 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 Well, she works hard. She's a teacher. She works really a lot of hours. And that's one of the days we take care of, because we have to like cook for the whole week.
Yeah.
yeah. a lot of times. And so that, it really screwed things up. I didn't, wasn't that I didn't understand, but not only that, the thing is I had not played when I did that, when I first went to church, I had not played the violin in like a month. And it was the first time that I set it aside and then didn't have dark thoughts and depression. Cause every other time I tried to set aside, I would get really bad anxiety or depression and I would go back to it and it would get better. But that didn't happen. I was doing okay. Mm-hmm. And so I was trying to convey to her, yeah, I understand that you think that this is just another thing that I'm trying to, you know, that I'm going to put between you and me, but it's not the same. Something is different now. Mm-hmm. I tried to convey that to her and I don't blame her for not getting it, but she didn't really get it. And she went to bed and she was kind of upset. And then I went to bed and I think it was like 3 o'clock in the morning. I felt her foot touch my foot in the bed. And so I knew that she was awake and that she didn't hate me. And I got to tell you, I've never said anything like this in my life. I'm laying in the bed and in my mind, I said, please God, help me make her understand. And I don't know what I was asking. I don't even know. It just came out. And I certainly didn't expect anything to happen right then. But it did. So, you know that feeling, Paul, when like if you hug somebody that you really love and they hug you back, like especially your children, and you can, it's like a feeling of warmth, and it can be so strong that you start to come to tears if you, if you're really in that moment.
Yeah,
it was like that, but it was like 10,000 times. Okay, it was. If you took all the times I ever felt that feeling and put them in the bathtub, it might fill up the bathtub. Mm-hmm. But this was like a sea of this love and joy. That's the way I thought of it, as just a sea of joy. Mm-hmm. And it was weird because I could feel it really strongly on me. But at the same time, it was like I was in the presence of joy itself. Mm. Because it felt, you know how when you're, the way I thought about it afterwards, because I try to think of some way that I can convey what this is like. But you know how, like, if you're floating in a really large body of water, like the ocean or like a lake where you can't see the end, you feel the water on your body, and then you can kind of feel more of the water because of the waves. And then you can look out, and it looks infinite. It was like I had a sensation of infinity. And so I'm lying, and this time when it happened, it did kind of well up right after I said that to myself. And I start crying because it's so overwhelming. And my wife says, why are you crying? And then I just explode onto her with all of this love. And I'm saying things to her that I never could say before. I told you, it was like I was numb before. There were feelings that I couldn't access. I couldn't find a way to be romantic, and it always bothered her. And I always knew it was there. I tried to deny it, and I didn't understand what was going on, but I felt it. And then it was like the dam burst open.
Wow.
And it just flooded all over her.
Wow.
And it went on. On and it lasted. I remember I was really thinking, I really felt like something is working through me. Something is happening right now. Something's going on. Mm-hmm. And then it got to the point where I couldn't take it anymore. Mm-hmm. And I remember I said out loud, I feel like I'm drowning in my tears, because I put my fingers to my eyes and I wasn't sobbing or anything like that. And I wasn't sad. I mean, I was as happy as I've ever been, like times 100. Mm-hmm. And the water is just pouring out of my eyes. Mm-hmm. The tears are just pouring out of my eyes. And I said, I don't know what's happening. I said, I don't know what I did to deserve this, because it was just so incredible. And I really felt, at the same time I felt wonderful, I really felt sorry. I really felt like I don't deserve this. Like, it was like, oh my God. You know, I mean, like, really. Mm-hmm. And it was later helping with your videos, again, helped me frame things that I fully, fully believe that I had an encounter with God number two. Mm-hmm. And that was God number two. And And so we get up and start the day, and it's still really early in the morning, and we're having a great time just hanging out together before everybody has to get, really start the day. But I keep thinking, why did that happen to me? What did I do to deserve that? And why did it happen? Because one of the reasons why I kept asking is because I already believed in God. And when that happened, it was like, there's a difference between believing and then there's knowing. It was like, why did I get that confirmation? Because it was complete confirmation for me. Why did that happen? Mm-hmm. And I kept asking myself, and then I had to get dressed and I went to work and I was driving to work and I kept asking that in my mind, why did that happen to me? And all of a sudden I had a thought. And right after I had the thought, the same thing happened, the same feeling. But instead of welling up, it was like a blast. Wow. And it was... I crumpled. I mean, it was like a flower wilting in too much sunlight. Mm-hmm. And I burst into tears again. Mm-hmm. And I was driving to work. And so I thought, I can't go to work like this. So I actually said out loud, okay, I get it. The thought that I had was, it was for her. Mm. And I'm not sure that I understood what that meant. I mean, I knew what it meant, but it was for my wife. I knew that.
Right.
But I didn't understand, all of the ramifications of that and everything. And so I said, okay, I get it. And then I don't know how much longer it was after that. I was still driving in my car. And then I had a vision. And then again, the same thing, a blast. Mm-hmm. And it was even stronger than the time before. Mm-hmm. And I swear, it felt like if it had been stronger, that it could have killed me. It was so, so incredibly intense that I was like shrinking down in my seat when I was driving. Mm-hmm. And I swear that it was an overcast day, and so there was no sun. But for a second, it was as if I was in a rainbow. I could see the colors blue and red, just faintly. And by the way, I know this sounds crazy, okay? The vision I had was pure, it was like pure white, but there was a silhouette, and the silhouette was me proposing to my wife.
Wow.
And then I start, and so again, I said, okay, now I get it. That wasn't all, right. I got it now.
Right.
I said that out loud.
Yep.
And then it subsided, and I could stop crying. And then I start thinking, then it occurs to me, oh yeah, this is my 20th wedding anniversary this year. Well, that's probably a good idea. Because I felt like this is something I have to do. I felt like God just told me that I have to propose to my wife to like renew our marriage. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then I remembered, well, she doesn't even wear her engagement ring. She lost it for a while and then she doesn't wear it. We never had real wedding bands. Mm. We got married at the Justice of the Peace. And then we had a service at the Unitarian Church. Mm-hmm. And so all of this story starts to fill up my mind about how we can renew our marriage in a way that's recognized by the church, and that I'm a different person now because I'm really feeling all of this romanticism towards her. Mm-hmm. And I start seeing how the whole story of my life starts to change as I look back over it. It was as if all of that time that I spent suffering over not being able to play the violin and regretful of everything that I did wrong, now all of a sudden it's like, that's okay, because you know what? It actually did make me a better person. Hmm. Because I had to cope with that, and then I had to deal with not being able to do it, and I had to live with that, and I had to work on myself, and that all of that is the reason that Jordan Peterson had such an effect on me, and the reason that I read all the books that I read, and the reason that I went to church. All of that was because I was suffering with that issue. And so like the story changed, and then I remember something else that just blew my mind, because the previous day when I was in church, I went to the Bible study. At the Bible study, the issue that they talked about was, were Mary and Joseph married when she had Jesus? And the guy doing the Bible study said that there's an ancient Jewish tradition where you get legally married, but you're not really married, and you can call the whole thing off. and then you establish a home together and you have like a year or so to do that. And then you're really married. And so you have people that are legally married, and then Jesus comes into their life, and then they're really married. Hmm. And that framework just like fit with exactly what was, it was like it was being revealed to me, mm-hmm, that this is the story now. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I have to do this. Mm-hmm. So I bought rings, and I thought, the first time I did this, it wasn't very romantic. It has to be romantic. Mm-hmm. I tell you, the whole week after this happened, I was like Scrooge on Christmas morning. I was so elated all the time. I had to stop myself from doing things that I probably should have done, but they seemed like they were crazy. Like I was just going to tell coworkers how awesome, how much I love them. And I felt this way. I said so many romantic things to my wife. I would text her and just gushing all over her that, I mean, she loved it. Thankfully she loved it. It wasn't too much, but it was just crazy. And then, so I thought I ultimately decided on going, take her to New York and doing a proposal in Central Park. And so I go there and I do that, and I kind of messed it up because I said too much God stuff when I did it. And even though we had a great time and she really appreciated everything I did, and she really appreciated how different I was, and I was trying to convey to her that this is a new me and that magic is real and we're going to have a magical marriage and fairy tales are real. I'm like just exploding all this stuff on her. And she is, you know, so confused. And if it were me back 2 or so years ago, then I totally understand. But the other thing I wanted to tell you is that, and I told you this in the email though, but we were there, and after I did all of that, and we're lying in bed in the hotel room, and it dawned on me that we're in New York and my last name is York. And I'm telling my wife how I'm a new person. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to have a new marriage. Mm-hmm. Our last name is York, right?
Right.
And
right.
It's just things like that just kept happening. And it was, you know, when you had that discussion you had with, I don't know how long we're going. I really want to hear what you have. Keep going.
The person after you canceled, so.
Okay, well, you had the discussion when, I think his name was Darren, who's an astrophysicist, and he talked about Psalm 5:3.
Yeah.
When I heard that, I thought, oh, it'd be nice to have some synchronicity. That would be great. And then that was when I realized, oh, yeah, well, there is a priest doing Jordan Peterson meetup, and that's kind of synchronicitous. And then all this other stuff happened. I'm like, wow. You know, it's just the whole thing, it still blows my mind. And I cannot explain to you how different I feel. I started to see my wife, the only way I know how to say it is, I started to see her through God's eyes. I felt like God was trying to get to her through me. And that was part of the reason that I was so much easier to love her, so more romantic. But also there's something about, I kept thinking that something happened whenever, because it feels like the hierarchy got set straight, because I had violin at the top, and then it got replaced by God, and then when God replaced it, now all of a sudden my wife is the most important thing that I can, it's like my family, but particularly my wife, is so vital that we have the best relationship we can have. Because I start thinking about, infinity with her and us, and that whole, all of the cosmic meaning behind that. And that's the way it's been ever since. I do the prayers as many times as I can every day. I have this feeling that I just want to get out of my own way and do whatever God wants me to do. That's the way I honestly feel about it. And that's what I was mean when I was trying, when I was saying before, there's something that, tells you should do things sometimes. And I mean, that you can get, that can be wrong if you're not set up right.
So I try to be
careful.
Yeah.
But I feel like I'm certainly set up better than I ever was.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm dealing with that. So, I mean, like, one of the things I wanted to ask you about is, what is a religious experience? And then when you have one, because I think
have to ask?
Well, no, okay.
You just explained it. You just described it.
Okay. So then if we establish that, then my next question is, now what?
Yeah. Because commonly you're in the honeymoon.
Yeah.
And you know what a honeymoon is.
Yeah.
And
yeah, everything's great right now.
Everything's great right now. And that probably won't last.
No, well, it certainly won't, you know.
No. And God, you know, there are books full of conversion stories. And yeah. If you would read some of those books, you would read your story, because okay. What you've just talked about is it's see, part of the difficulty is if we share this publicly, a lot of people are going to hear this and they're going to say, I want what that guy got.
Yeah.
They're not going to get it.
Well,
because they might.
Yeah.
But everyone is different.
It's hard for me to say what it is. If it took me, whatever that was, 30 minutes.
Yeah. Well, everyone is different. Everyone's story is different. And what you received has been grace. It's pure grace. It was, it was God's gift to you. And here's the thing about God and his gifts.
Mm-hmm.
God gives gifts. Whatever gift he gives to whomever he chooses to give it.
Mm-hmm.
So people are going to hear your story and they're going to say, I wanted his story, but you got your story. Other people get their story. My story is different from yours. And so, and then people are, well, we're American. So we're like, well, we want God to be fair. And well, that's hard, because chances are good. So for example, let's think about the Apostle Paul.
Mm-hmm.
The Apostle Paul is zealous. I really enjoy N.T. Wright's biography of the Apostle Paul
started reading it. It's great so far.
And so here you have the Apostle Paul, and he's zealous for the Lord, and that means hunting down these heretics that were following this Jesus of Nazareth. And then, of course, Jesus appears to him on the road to Damascus, and then he's blind. He's blinded, and then, you know, Ananias is told, go see Paul and pray for him. And Ananias is like, whoa, you know, mm-hmm. And the Lord says, first of all, God says, you know, you're asking about what this voice is. Well, sometimes it's God.
Right. And sometimes it is. Yeah.
Sometimes it's God. And Ananias says to him, you know, first of all, when I call, you don't, but me, because and anyone who has any brains at all doesn't. If you play chicken with God, if you decide you're going to challenge God, God can go to extraordinary lengths to get his way. So stop going along with him. But so, and God says to Ananias, you know, basically, you know, I'll show him how much he will suffer for me. And so it's suffering is always part of the package of the Christian life.
Right.
And some people get it at the front end, some people get it at the back end, some people get more than others. And again, it's what God gives. But there's always the sense that when God, the question is, so I'm, you know, people know me as a Calvinist, which I am. And then the question with Calvinism is always this question about divine election and God's will for our lives. And one of the big things is that Israel is elect, you know, chosen by God, and chosen by God to suffer. Mm-hmm. And Jesus is elect. That's what Christ means, anointed one, chosen by God to suffer. And so people are like, well, why does he get elected and not them? But yeah, be careful about the election you ask for, because you read Dostoevsky. So, you know, I think I love your story, and it'll be amazing to see what God does with it, because this is how God works.
Mm-hmm.
And why people will listen to you. People will listen to you. And I think this is part of our industrial age. We get so used to, you know, every phone coming out looking the same. that we think, oh, the world is supposed to work that way. Yeah, people aren't that way at all. Mm-hmm. And our lives aren't that way at all. So no, God is clearly working on you and working through you. And God is working his story through you and your story through him. And it's just beginning. Well, that, you know, and what I love about your story is that the way you tell your story nicely shows how in Christianity, we have this question about, well, when Jesus comes again, when God kind of brings this chapter called human history to its conclusion, well, what about all the bad things? Well, stories actually have the power to work backwards.
Yeah.
And we see that all the time in good movies. Good movies, oh, it's terrible. And then you get to the end, and then suddenly all of the tragedy that happened before, all of the loss and failure now suddenly gets shifted. And you see, was it hard? Yeah. Was it terrible? Yeah. But in the end, somehow it gets turned to glory. So God does these things.
I'm still uncomfortable with it.
Because we're Americans, and what's the creed of being an American? I'm in charge of my life. No one writes my story but me. That's the American creed, and it's a stupid one.
Yeah,
it's first of all, it isn't true to begin with because your parents had you, and all these other factors had in your life, and so no, we're part of God's story, and he's telling stuff through us, and a part of us really doesn't like it. And that goes all the way back to Genesis 3. So yours is a wonderful story. It's a beautiful story. And it's all grace. It's just God's gift to you.
Right.
So, Tim,
I'm not going to understand it.
Is. Nope. So one of the things I think about, and okay, I'm a pastor, so I'm supposed to talk this way. But when I think about your love for the violin, and I started playing the violin when I was 6. I haven't done anything with it. I don't have the same love for a violin that you do. I had the opportunity to start playing when I was 6. Some of the people that I learned violin with when I was in first grade went on to be professional violinists. They are doing that now. You have, sounds like a gift, and you certainly have a desire, but by virtue of your life story, you know, will you ever be a concert violinist? Probably not. But probably not here and now. What about the next chapters? I don't know. But again, it seems to me when suddenly we imagine that the universe is, you know, the world is, you know, consciousness is primary, and all of this stuff in the world gets shaped and moved and managed and colonized by consciousness and story. Mm-hmm. Well, this is only the beginning of our stories.
Yeah.
And that then really makes us uncomfortable, because then we really have to confess we don't know a lot, and we don't. But so what is God doing? I don't know, but sure is interesting.
At least it's that.
Well, and God is good. I mean, your story is so beautiful. And, you know,
it really is beautiful, especially the part about me and my wife. It's really, even though I still feel like she's supposed to come on board with me on this stuff.
Maybe she will and maybe she won't.
Right. Maybe she will. And I know I can't force it. I know if I have any chance at all, it's just by continuing to love her the way I have been.
That's right.
And you know, maybe she'll feel like there's something else that she needs to be involved, you know, something that she needs to learn. I don't know.
But your job is to love her. That's your job.
Right.
And but it's not, that's your job.
It makes so much sense that if God wanted to get to her, it would go through me though, doesn't it?
Yeah. But God is an amazing novel writer. And like all good novelists, there are twists and turns and ironies and sometimes tragedies, the likes that we don't know how to manage, and life is full of those things. So right. I don't want to rain on your parade, but you know,
it's okay.
You know, you're talking to you reminds me of Sheldon Van Auken's novel, not novel, his story, A Severe Mercy.
Mm-hmm.
It's as Sheldon Van Auken was, he was a friend of personal friend of C.S. Lewis, and his life started out, he and his wife had the kind of relationship that very, very few people have. I mean, just intense, loving. Mm-hmm. I mean, you read the story of his relationship with his wife, and it sounds, I mean, the people who write romance novels, they can't write this well. I mean, it's just amazing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, but then don't you know what's coming?
Right. Death.
You know, they're separated by death. I won't give away any spoilers.
Right.
But so then you have the question, why would God give such an amazing gift
mm-hmm.
and then let death take it? So now Sheldon Van Auken, now he has to deal with that.
Right.
And, you know, C.S. Lewis obviously had, you know, a similar thing in terms of eventually, you know, lifelong bachelor. Finally, he and Joy Davidman, you know, strange relationship, strange woman, strange man, fall in love, true bliss, you know, a miraculous healing. And then the cancer comes back and she's taken from him. And this man that helped so many people come to Christ now doubts the whole business. You know, only God can write stories like that. But it's because it's true. That's why we say truth is stranger than fiction, because novelists wouldn't dare write the kinds of, and your story's like that. You know, it's just amazing. It's beautiful.
Yeah. I don't know. I feel like the answer to all those things you're saying is that death's not the end of the story though.
Right. That's right. That's right. Exactly. And but again, if you go back and you look at your atheist self a number of years ago.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, that's
you'd
crazy.
Hear that and you'd say, you know, it's not the end of the story. This is the beginning of the story.
Right.
And well then see, and right then you're stuck with the dilemma of trust. Because even if you've had an amazing experience like yours, and it's like, I want, you know, now I have a sense of the power of what God can do.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then it's like, okay, God, why don't you zap her or
right.
him or them? And see, that's the problem with this idea about this crazy gift of grace that God gives. Why here and now and not there and them?
Right. Well, it's complicated.
Yeah. Well, with the Apostle Paul. Paul is standing there holding the cloaks of the people stoning Stephen. And mm-hmm. you might say, well, you know, Lord, if you had kind of showed up to him, I mean, if you can show up to him on the road of Damascus a few years later, couldn't you just move the timeline up a little bit?
Yeah, that's the way that I used to think, stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, why didn't he just pick up all the Jews in his infinite way and then move them out of Egypt?
What a little cloud.
With all of this drama.
That's right.
Yeah, but that, yeah.
So, I don't know. Maybe I'm not being helpful at all because...
No, no, yeah, I mean, gift. There's not very many people I can tell a story to. And so I just really appreciate being able to tell it to you. I've told it to Father David. Because I felt like I really needed to tell him, and I feel like he was and his church was a part of it.
Yeah.
And he gave me some great advice, which, you know, was you have to honor that. He said a couple of times, the way he says it with his deep voice is, you were told. Yeah. Your wife comes first. Yeah. And then, you know, he was really glad that I told him, and he gave me a hug. And, you know, and I told him when we started, I've never had a meal with a priest before. This is outrageous.
Yeah,
I told a woman at work a little bit about the experiences that I had, who's an atheist, And she suggested I might need to get an MRI or a CAT scan. And there's a part of me that is still so connected with that way of thinking that I can actually think that about myself sometimes, you know, in a way, even after all of that.
I people say those kinds of things to me and I just laugh because where my church is, I'm on a daily basis dealing with homeless people, schizophrenics, people with bipolar. I see crazy all day long.
Yeah.
You're kind of crazy. People would pay money for. I mean, it's just,
yes, thank you. I mean, I certainly agree because it, you know, I can't, I don't know that I can totally ascribe it to what happened to me, but I don't have eczema right now. I don't have seborrheic dermatitis. This, I never would grow this out because I would get it here and it would flake and itch and be red. And I've had this I actually trimmed it once, but I haven't shaved it in a month and I don't have that. I do have this cream that I've been using, but nothing has ever worked. So I don't think the cream is really it could be
the
cream. But it's kind of funny how I feel so much better in many, many ways.
Yeah.
Even in that way.
Yeah.
And you know, I read one time that anxiety is the feeling you get when you stare into the abyss. And I never understood what that meant. But now that I feel like the hole in my soul, which I think that really was what that was, is closed up. I feel like it's closed up.
Yeah.
It's like the anxiety's gone.
Yeah.
I mean, even the things that gave me the most anxiety don't give me anxiety.
Yeah.
And I cannot express how amazing that is.
Yeah. Well, and part of the problem we have in the West is we have adopted a, in my opinion, a rather arbitrary position that things like this don't happen. And that position is maintained contrary to fact. So Craig Keener, someone just pointed me to some lectures that Craig Keener was given in Biola. Craig Keener is a New Testament scholar who married a woman from Africa, and he's done two volumes on miracles. And he's just going story after story after story after story. I just, in fact, a conversation that I will share because I've got a whole bunch of them stacked out for the second part of this month when I'm not going to be posting a lot. But someone will tell a story about how, you know, this guy had diabetes and this he was praying. He wasn't on any drugs at the moment. And, you know, a being of light shows up, touches him in the head. And for the next few months, he has no diabetes. Now, you know, here's something about diabetes. You don't, it isn't none, you know, type 1 diabetes is not psychosomatic.
No,
it's medically diagnosable. You can do a blood test. I mean, if you're pricking your finger and you're not taking insulin and your sugar levels are okay, well, you know, your pancreas kicked in again. You know what? It doesn't matter. But you know, so what you just described happens, and it happens all over the world, and it's happened all through human history, and so. This American idea that this stuff doesn't happen, that's a story that has been propagated on certain populations in the world that most people in the world look at and laugh at.
It's definitely just another story.
It's another story.
Yeah. Like I could say that the things that happened to me, it was some kind of just psychological experience that suddenly my ego opened up and emotions that I couldn't capture before, all of a sudden I can get to them in some way. You know, there's like a psychotherapeutic terminology around that, but that doesn't explain the feeling of infinite joy at all to me. And it doesn't explain the fact that when it happened, it was like, I'm sure what that was.
And you, so this is where language, you know, a lot of the stuff that I'm working on, people want to then use the word supernatural. And I would say, well, that there's another story, you know, the natural supernatural.
It's not supernatural if there is infinite consciousness. If that is the natural world, then it's not supernatural.
Exactly. And the fact that, did you have a psychological experience? Absolutely. That was a psychological experience. It's just that we have all these stories of causality that we use to account for things. But then the second turn we take is that we can control these stories of causality. And the really hilarious thing is we believe that. And it's so farcical because people aren't in control of themselves at all. If we really were in control of this world, then all of the ways that we say we want the world to be, the world would be like that. And it isn't. So then you have to say, well, what's really going on? Well, now we're into areas that we are motivated to not want to believe for very real reasons. I do not want to believe that I am not in control of myself. I do not want to believe that someone else is writing a script for my life. And we somehow imagine that it will feel better if we'll call it random.
Yeah.
Well, what does random mean? Random means too complicated for us to understand. Well, that's more true than nobody's in charge. Well, if nobody's in charge, then we should probably live in total terror. That's part of the reason why I've never, you know, if my doubts get going far enough, I get to the point of thinking that whole doubting business, it just doesn't take me anywhere. I might as well believe. I might as well keep believing.
Yeah.
So, but I love your story. I love your story. So we still have some time if you want. If you have any questions on your sheet, or anything else you wanted to talk about, or if you basically wanted to share your story or what your goal was, I don't know, but I did read your email, and I remember part of the difference is I get an email, and I actually bought that book right when I got your email, because like, oh, I got to read that.
Really? Well.
Oh, yeah. Because you told your story, and then Father David sent me an email and said, oh, I just met Tim, and he gushed on you for a while.
Okay, well, I cannot recommend that book highly enough. And you should look up Bernardo Kastrup. Strangely enough, this is another thing I got from Joe Rogan. He just tweeted out an article that this guy wrote one day. And then when I investigated who he was, I found his books. He has actually gotten another PhD now. He's doing his dissertation in idealism.
Wow.
And he's about to come out with another book that's full of his peer-reviewed articles on idealism. And he's got particle physics and psychedelic research, neuroscience research to back his theories up. And that's like his goal, to establish a peer-reviewed, scientifically sustainable, idealist perspective or theory, whatever the proper terminology is, to try to break through the materialist worldview in science.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, what a goal, right?
Yeah, it's an amazing goal.
He's a brilliant, brilliant guy. So I think, especially since I know that you have been reading that Michael Pollan book, there's a lot about psychedelics in his books, and particularly that one.
Interesting.
I mean, the other thing that we kind of talked about it is this whole thing about what is a calling and where does your interest come from? Because for the longest time, I thought that I was crazy and doing the wrong thing by not being able to stop playing the violin. And I felt guilty about it because of what it was doing with my marriage. And it's not like those feelings have necessarily gone away totally, but I do feel differently about it now. I have this thing, I think about things a lot, and I have this kind of thing that sometimes I feel like when I've gotten to the answer, because sometimes when I have a realization, I'll just start bawling. And one of those times when I was ruminating on why did I do that for so long, I came to the conclusion that, well, I was being honest. I mean, it was honestly what I loved. And it was, and I kept asking, why can't I stop doing that and just focus on being the best lawyer I can be? I see other people doing that. Why can't I do that? And then I would think, well, look at those, some of those other people, they're divorced, their kids are in a bad way, they're not healthy themselves. Maybe they don't have it right. Maybe, even though this doesn't seem to be right in some ways, it feels like I'm supposed to do this. It just feels like that.
Yeah.
And sometimes I think that I was just supposed to do it, you know? And when I start thinking this way, and I start thinking how now that I can make up for all of that with my wife, which seems to be happening, maybe it was okay. Maybe I was supposed to do that. Maybe I was even doing the right thing by at least being honest and at least, you know, I mean, I don't, that's just what I thought. And when I thought that, it was like, it felt like the truth.
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, I don't know what that is.
There's a lot of people that wish they had something as an obsession as glorious as violin playing.
You haven't heard me play.
Well,
the violin music is glorious. I don't know about my playing, but
well, I know what it means to squeak on a violin.
Oh yeah.
I don't know. Our lives are deeply mysterious, and how all this, you know, this obsession we have with answers. So this morning, you know, I'm working on a video that maybe I'll have time to record today. My schedule's just nuts lately, but on, you know, back to Peterson talking about Piaget and his equilibrated state. And so I re-listened to some of Peterson's lectures on Piaget, and you know, basically, all is at rest is in some ways kind of like dead. And, mm-hmm. You know,
I'll let you mind. I got to tell you something else in a minute. Sorry, go ahead.
So, you know, God disturbs us, and God disturbs us because, you know, C.S. Lewis, one of his more famous quotes that people absolutely hate, you know, pain is God's megaphone for a deaf world. You know, I remember one person hearing that, you know, thinking, what does that really make God? And so, you know, these are hard, hard questions, but your violin, the role that your desire to play the violin has played throughout your life, it's very interesting. And I do believe that there will be satisfaction and glory from it someday. But that's just one of these things that God enjoys writing.
Well, Now I'm okay with it. I'm actually, I put it away, and I can't say it won't ever come back, but I'm okay with it now. It's like I wasn't before. Yeah. And I do have my daughter who plays piano, and I love practicing with her, and she has the same kind of things about not focusing sometimes.
Yeah.
I know what that is, and now I know how to deal with it. And so having, you know, I never had somebody like me there to be patient with her and walk her through what you need to do.
Yeah.
In doing that. And I learned these things from what I went through. Right.
Yeah.
And now, so even though I never have gotten to be a professional violin teacher, I'm like an amateur piano teacher with my daughter, and it is extremely meaningful. I mean, it's like one of my favorite things to do.
Oh, it's wonderful. It's just wonderful. It's such a great story.
There was one other thing I wanted to tell you.
Okay.
It's just another part of this whole thing that happened. The Friday before we went to New York, I had a dream. And because of all the Jung that I read, I try to, you know,
yep.
lot of dreams mean anything.
Yeah.
But I had this dream, and I was in my grandmother's house, and this was the grandmother who was a Baptist. And I just had this feeling like everything was just right. And it was hazy. It's not like I could really see things in my grandmother's house, but I knew I was in my grandmother's house, and I knew that everything was just right, and there was a lot of light. And then I heard the garage door open, and I went to open the door to the garage, and I see the garage door opening up, and I see my wife getting out of the car, and she's got the two dogs with her that we had before we had kids. And I just get this feeling like, you know, here she is, right? She's coming. And then when I wake up, that was it. But I wake up, I was the most peaceful that I ever felt.
Wow.
I mean, just completely, completely at peace. You know, I can't explain it other than to say that. It was just so incredibly peaceful. And I don't know what it meant. I mean, I have a guess.
This
was after all this stuff happened, and I felt like, you know, I was in the place of my ancestors, so to speak, and that my wife was on her way. That's what I felt about it. But anyway, I just wanted to tell you that.
I love your story. I love your story. It's good. It's good. It's really good. Oh, well,
I don't know about posting this.
I can understand. I can understand because, you know, you're a lawyer. You've got, you know,
people. Yeah. Yeah.
People and trust you.
And my wife will have to be okay with it.
No, absolutely. So what I will do is I will send you the copy. You share it with your wife and you think about it. And if you decide you want to share it, let me know. I'd be happy to share it.
Okay. But, well, I want to know what you think too. I mean, do you think you gave me a little bit of a warning, which I'm going to think about.
I think it's a story that would encourage and inspire people. Other people would listen to it and feel, why didn't God give me that story? That's something they're going to have to deal with God. Your God's story for you is his gift to you. And if you would share it, I know that people would, I know that others would be really encouraged by it. But I think it's important that you and your wife think about it and decide, and only when you're comfortable would we share something like this.
Okay. I appreciate that.
No, because it's important, because this is
YouTube is for people that have nothing to lose, and I don't feel that way. Right.
Well, I mean, no, yeah, and you're right. I think we would all probably be a little bit better generally sharing a little bit more with each other.
I do too. And I want to get there, but I have to be careful about it. And I definitely have to have my wife's okay.
Yes, you do. And it's because, again, your job, you know, the most clear thing Jesus says to us. So we had a meetup in Southern California, and Job was there. I've done three videos with Job. Mm-hmm. And Job was there, and Job was just sharing with us because he's been reading the Bible. And he said, he was reading the Gospel of John, and he said, it's a really strange thing that Jesus, before he leaves, he says to his disciples, here's the one thing I want you to know, and the most important thing I'm going to tell you is that you need to love each other. And Job was like, there's something kind of strange to that, isn't it? That you know, this is the one thing. This is the one thing. And so, you know, in terms of everything you need to do, you need to love your wife. And so that's whether or not she follows you in this path.
Yeah.
And so here's the joy. Every great joy has on the other side of it a burden.
Yes.
And so
that's the right word.
You love her, you love her whatever the path. And that's the cross. Because the cross, carrying the cross that's the journey of love. And Americans don't think that way about it, but that's what it is. So no, I close this, and then the video gets rendered, and then I'm gonna ship it to you, and you watch it with your wife, and you two decide. And if you decide that you're comfortable sharing it and you'd like to, let me know and I'll post it. Otherwise, okay. It'll just stay between us.
Well, thank you for everything you do, Paul. Seriously.
Oh, it's
I really appreciate it.
You know, really this is so much fun. This is so much fun.
But it's not easy either, all the time, I'm sure.
But that's what love requires, right?
Yeah. Well, God bless you.
God bless you. Thank you for sharing your story with me.
All right.
Take care.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.